Good afternoon, everyone. I am Susie Coleman Archer with the Provost's Office here at Vanderbilt University, and I want to thank you for your attendance this afternoon at the university's second observance of Constitution Day. And for those of you who are not familiar with Constitution Day, late in 2004, Congress enacted legislation that created Constitution Day. What it required was that all institutions that were recipients of federal funds should provide a program on or around September 17th in recognition of the American Constitution, beginning in 2005. Last year was our first year for observing Constitution Day, and it was a program that debated the very constitutionality of Constitution Day, a discussion led by Ed Rubin, the dean of the law school. This year, our second observance in what will soon become an annual observance, we are going to take another look at the Constitution. I have a distinguished panel here that will discuss legislating from the bench. It will focus on the judicial role in our Constitution, and we have some differing views, some explanations, some very interesting views of the judicial role in the Constitution. Let me introduce to you our panel, if you will. On my far left is Mark Brandon, who is a professor of law and political science from the law school. Next to Mark is Stephanie Lindquist, who is an associate professor of political science and law in the College of Arts and Science. And we have our distinguished student members of the panel. We have Mr. Thomas Traxler, who is a senior in the College of Arts and Science, majoring in political science, and Mr. Lawrence Staden, who is also a senior in the College of Arts and Science, majoring in political science. So the stage is set, and without taking up any further time, I'm going to turn the presentation over to our panelists. Each will give you his or her view of the role of the judiciary in our Constitution. And then we're going to have some time for questions and answers. So you should feel free to hold those questions and just put them out there because this group can answer them. Okay? All right. Stephanie, you're going to be first.
Well, as Susie has indicated, my name is Stephanie Lindquist. I'm an associate professor of political science and law. And it's my pleasure to be here today to observe Constitution Day with my colleague Mark Brandon and my students Tom Traxler and Lawrence Staden, who were in my constitutional law class last semester, and a small but hearty band of Constitution scholars in the audience. So thank you so much for coming. There is much to applaud in our Constitution. It is certainly a visionary document framed by men who had a long-term view and were sensitive to both the weaknesses and strengths of human beings when it came to self-governance. As some would say, we don't have just a good constitution, we have the best damn constitution in the world. But the document itself was formulated, as I said, with a view for the long term. And as a result, the original document, as well as the Bill of Rights that modified that document later, after the ratification of the Constitution, are broadly worded and in some contexts are ambiguous. This next cartoon illustrates that point. As a matter of fact, I have read the Constitution, and frankly, I don't get it. Ambiguous texts always raise an important issue, and that is the scope of discretion left to those who must interpret the document and those ambiguous phrases. In our Constitution, that should mean all of us, the electorate, elected officials, and judges. But since 1803, the final word on the interpretation of the document, constitutional document, has fallen largely on the judicial branch. In fact, Chief Justice Marshall engineered it that way in a spectacular power grab that we now know as Marbury versus Madison. Now, what is judicial activism? Often in discussing a constitutional interpretation, critics of the court suggest that the court has been too activist in its decision making. What is judicial activism and where did the term come from? Often it's referred to as legislating from the bench. The first or earliest reference to the term was made in 1947 in a Fortune magazine article by Arthur Schlesinger. And in that article, he located the justices along an ideological continuum, anchored on one end by Justices Black and Douglas, and on the other end by Justices Frankfurter and Jackson. And he compared them in terms of their willingness to actively interpret the Constitution or to be restraintist in their interpretation. Often in that time, the term activism was used with a positive connotation rather than a negative connotation. Justice Black and Douglas were viewed more positively. But now, like the word liberal, it has come to achieve mainly a negative connotation. And as I said, it's compared to this idea of judicial restraint, which is considered to be the opposite of judicial activism. So what is activism? How can we define it? First, we can think about it in terms of the extent to which constitutional or unconstitutional actions by other branches of government are struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court or by any other federal judge. And we refer to this as the counter-majoritarian difficulty, is a term of art that has been used to apply to this context. Counter-majoritarian because here the court is acting in a matter that counteracts policies that are rendered by a majority in a democracy, presumably through the legislative process. In addition, we can think about activism as a situation in which, through their decision-making, judges restrict the policy space available to other governmental officials. That is, they limit, through their decision-making, the scope of elected officials' power. For example, you might think of that in the context of the national surveillance issue that has arisen in American politics today, and with respect to the question whether or not George Bush has the authority to wiretap without a warrant. In addition, we can think of activism in terms of the extent to which judges ignore or overturn existing precedent. Precedent is, of course, the stabilizing influence within our judicial system. Judges are, through the norm of stare decisis, considered obligated at some level to adhere to existing precedents and decisions they have rendered in the past. And to the extent that they deviate from those decisions, it might be considered activist. In addition, oftentimes when we think about legislating from the bench, we think about judicial opinions that create regulations or legislative-type rules. And the typical anecdotal evidence given in support of this situation is where the court in Roe v. Wade set forth a trimester framework to regulate women's right to have an abortion, with less regulations in the first trimester and increasingly restrictive regulations as the pregnancy continued. That looked to some like the kind of regulations that would be formulated by a legislature rather than by a judiciary. Now, what are the arguments against activism in these various forms? First, the main argument is that federal judges, of course, are unelected. Now, we can compare federal judges to state judges because in some states, of course, the judges are elected. So these same questions of counter-majoritarianism would not necessarily arise. But as we know in the federal judiciary, federal judges are appointed for life by the president. And they are therefore not part of our elected body of elected officials. As a result, it does seem somewhat incongruous with the notion of democracy that these unelected judges would be able to countermand the decisions of our democratically elected officials. In addition, another argument is that courts are ill-equipped to engage in these kind of policy-making decisions, these kind of activist decisions, because judges themselves are part of a passive, the courts are passive institutions, that they must wait for litigants to bring cases to them, and the only tools they have in general to make their decisions are the tools made available to them by the litigants, that is, the arguments that are set forth to them before the court, as compared to a legislature that has a far more broad array of evidence available to them in the context of a legislative hearing where they can subpoena all sorts of individuals to come and testify on a particular policy matter. Of course, as I've already noted too, activism is arguably short-circuits the democratic process because it will cut off democratic debate. And we can see this in the context of Roe versus Wade, where the court unilaterally determined that states could not restrict abortion under certain circumstances, and that did terminate at some level, although it's actually continuing as we know, did terminate at some basic level the democratic debate regarding the appropriateness or the legality of abortion. And of course, the other argument about activism is that through the interpretation of broad phrases in the Constitution, such as due process, cruel and unusual punishment, etc., the interpretation of those phrases in conformity with a judge's own moral vision is inappropriate, given that judges are unelected. And that is another criticism of activism. And finally, you can see that an argument could be made that activism destabilizes the law. That is, if a judge is frequently overturning existing precedent, striking down statutes as unconstitutional, it does create a situation in which the law is less predictable. And we would like to have, in a system governed by the rule of law, have predictable and stable legal rules. Another example of how activism can transform the status quo can be seen in the case of the death penalty. In 1972, the Supreme Court struck down existing rules regarding the death penalty across all the states, those states that had the death penalty at the time, and commuted the death sentences of all inmates on death row at that point in time to a life imprisonment. So you can see how that form of decision-making can clearly change the legal rights and obligations of many, many individuals, and in this case, involving life and death. Now, what are the counterarguments that can be made more or less in favor of activism? First of all, when it comes to counter-majoritarianism and majoritarianism, it's clear that the founders did not intend a pure democracy. We have a system of separation of powers, of separated powers, and it was clearly intended to check majoritarian impulses. And in that sense, when the court acts in a counter-majoritarian fashion, one might view that as consistent with a framer's vision of how government would work. In addition, the existence of the Bill of Rights suggests that our system is not intended to work in a purely majoritarian fashion. The Bill of Rights itself requires protection of a minority against a tyrannical majority. And of course, most importantly perhaps, the Constitution is ambiguous, and there is no method to provide certainty in interpretation of phrases such as due process, cruel and unusual punishment, and equal protection of the law. I might also add, as a point on this slide that I didn't add to the slide, and that is that you could also make the argument that the other branches are not so majoritarian themselves. Think about, for example, the Electoral College in our presidential elections. In this situation, or in the way that the Electoral College works, presidents can be elected not only with only a plurality of the vote, but sometimes they can be elected even when they lose the popular vote. So you can think about all three institutions. None of the three are really purely majoritarian bodies. And for those who fear activism, you also want to consider something, a couple of other points. Courts themselves are subject to considerable constraints. So when we talk about activism, people raise the specter of courts that are charging in and supplanting the democratic process and imposing their will on the electorate. But in fact, courts are fairly powerless in many instances. They are, as I pointed out before, passive institutions. They have no power to implement their decisions, unlike the legislative branch that can create an agency to implement a policy. Courts have no such power. We say that they do not have the power of the sword nor the power of the purse. And this can be seen in the context of Brown versus Board of Education. It took about 10 years after Brown for African-American children in the South to actually see any level of integration in Southern schools as a result of legislative intervention. So the court itself was not particularly effective, even though Brown versus Board of Education is lauded as an important decision, and it is. It was not effective necessarily in actually driving integration in public schools. In addition, data has demonstrated, or social science studies have demonstrated, that the court's decisions are often consistent with public opinion. And that is true systematically, and you can also see it in the context of individual issue areas. We know that while Roe versus Wade created a trimester framework in 1973, over time the court has come to backtrack on that and to formulate abortion policy that more or less conforms to the majority's view regarding what are the appropriate restrictions and the appropriate freedoms when it comes to abortion. And always you have to bear in mind that while the court is interpreting the Constitution and in general has the final say, there is always the available option of a constitutional amendment to reverse the court, which has happened a couple of times in our history. So that the legislature and the electorate, of course, are not completely impotent when it comes to responding to activist decisions. Nevertheless, even though there are pros and cons and some useful counterarguments against those who cry activism, activism has nevertheless come to be used as a strong rhetorical device in modern history. It's used to criticize generally liberal judges more often than conservative judges. And this is somewhat ironic, as I think my colleagues here, my students, will point out, that activism has come to be raised as an issue of late by Republicans, but in fact more than 50% of federal judges on the bench right now, including on the Supreme Court, appointed by Republican presidents. And of course, conservative judges can be activists too. Really depends upon your judicial ideology, as we'll see with a couple of examples. We can look at liberal activist decisions. So Brown versus Board of Education nullified or eliminated state statutes mandating segregation in public schools in the South. Roe versus Wade changed the law of abortion. Miranda versus Arizona required the Miranda warnings, clearly a policymaking judgment on the part of the court to implement the constitutional amendments. And Romer versus Evans struck down a constitutional amendment in Colorado which limited homosexual gay rights. Those are certainly liberal decisions. But we can also look at some conservative decisions that were themselves activist. So in United States versus Morrison, the Violence Against Women Act, federal law, was struck down as unconstitutional. United States versus Lopez, another constitutional decision involving a federal law that restricted sales of guns around schools. I won't go into detail of the other decisions, but suffice it to say, you can easily list conservative activist decisions in the sense that they strike down legislation created by majoritarian bodies and legislatures as often as you can identify liberal activist decisions. And in my own research, what I've tried to do is sort out the relationship between activism and ideology. And this is a chart that I think can provide you with some information about the relationship between a judge's ideology and whether or not they'll be activists under certain circumstances. And what I have here along the x-axis is a measure of liberalism, or conservatism, however you want to see it. On the left are more liberal justices, on the right, more conservative justices. And each point on this chart represents an individual justice from the Rehnquist Court. On the left-hand side, you can see the percentage of times that those justices voted to strike statutes that were challenged before them on constitutional grounds. And this involves federal laws. And you can see here we're talking about challenges to strike liberal federal laws. So laws that were created by Democratic majorities in Congress that have liberal leanings. And if you look at this chart, you'll see that liberals are less inclined to strike such liberal laws, and conservatives are far more inclined to strike such laws. Compare conservative federal laws, laws that further conservative interests, are passed by Republican majorities in Congress, etc. You can see here that the liberals are far more inclined to strike those laws, and the liberals far more inclined to uphold, the liberals are far more inclined, and the conservatives far less inclined to strike those laws. So in an objective fashion, if you simply plot the relationship between the justices' ideology and their propensity to strike laws, you can see that what's really driving the justices here is not any particular restrainist or activist orientation, but rather their ideological response to the substance of the law at issue. And so if we take an objective position, we can see that both liberals and conservatives can be viewed as activists when looked at through the lens of social science. So what's the moral to this story? First, obviously, activism can be a convenient label, and you have to be sensitive to definitions and to be careful to compare, not use simply anecdotal evidence, but look across the board at all justices systematically to evaluate truly whether their behavior is activist or restrainist and whether there is a liberal bias to such a view. Recognize that activism can be in the eye of the beholder and that strict construction can be tough to achieve. If you look at my charts, you'll see that neither the conservatives nor the liberals are uniformly restrainist in all contexts, suggesting that it's tough to be restrainist in every case. So that is some social science evidence that sheds some light on the issue. I'm now going to turn the podium over to Mark Brandon, who will provide us, I think, with an historical perspective on the question.
I'm old-fashioned. I don't do PowerPoint. You don't want me to do PowerPoint. It would be a mess. Debates over judicial activism are certainly debates about the proper judicial role in the constitutional system, but they're also parts of a larger set of concerns about one, the basic character of the Constitution, and two, the best way to make sense of the Constitution, especially the best way for judges to make sense of the Constitution. And what I'd like to do is to take up these three little bite-sized, you could take a whole semester on these things. Okay, these three points briefly, start with proper role of judges in the constitutional system. And this question was controversial even from the beginning of the constitutional order. Now, the document that called itself the Constitution of the United States would, for the first time in the new nation's history, set up a national judiciary, including a mandated Supreme Court. And from the beginning, there was really no serious question but that the judiciary would play some role in the new order. But the people of the founding generation did disagree over some things. And one of the things they disagreed over was what specifically the role would be and how serious the role would be. Second, would it include judicial review? The power of a court, as Professor Lindquist just mentioned, the power of a court to declare an action or act of another branch of government or another unit of government unconstitutional. And third, whether this power, if it exists, is a good thing. Now, you can't survey the complete generation of founders, but let's take three. Okay, James Madison, father of the Constitution, right? He's a serious guy. He could not make up his mind what he thought about judicial power. He could not even make up his mind about what he thought about judicial review. At one point he says, or suggests anyway, that courts are really not going to have a significant role in the new constitutional system. And another point about judicial review, he suggests, well, judicial review is just part and parcel of constitutional order. You know, if you've got a constitution, as opposed to a treaty, if you've got a constitution, Madison says, courts are entitled to declare actions inconsistent with the Constitution unconstitutional. And another point, though, far from thinking that it's natural and non-controversial, he starts to worry and thinking, and he starts to think that, well, if courts can have this power of judicial review, that's going to be on the slippery slope to judicial supremacy. Pretty soon, judges are going to be telling us what to do. And that can't be right. We're setting up a republic, after all. And then, he says, well, maybe it's not a problem after all, because there are all these other departments around, and they can check the judiciary, because other departments can interpret the Constitution, too, within their respective spheres. Now, if he couldn't make up his mind, there are a couple of other people who did make up their minds. One who called himself Brutus was an opponent of the Constitution. He says, he looks at the Constitution, he says, whoa, the national judiciary is going to be extremely powerful. And the thing that Brutus worries about is not a judiciary versus president or Congress. In fact, Brutus says courts are going to end up allying themselves with Congress and the president, and what they're going to end up doing is, as a nation, subverting the status or sovereign powers of states. Now, Alexander Hamilton comes along and he says, on behalf of the Constitution, don't worry, it's all going to be okay. Yes, there's judicial review, but no, it's not a problem. Why is it not a problem? To tie into something that Professor Lindquist said, courts are weak. They don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword. They can't really tell us what to do in any serious way, but they can declare actions unconstitutional. They can't really do damage to other institutions. Now, in lots of ways, these concerns that are expressed at the beginning of the constitutional order are repeated in different guises in our own day. But one point's worth making, and that is, if the question is about the legitimacy of judicial review, that ship has sailed. That issue has been resolved as an historical matter, regardless of the original justification for it in Marshall's opinion in Marbury versus Madison. It's just a traditional way of part of the patterns and practices of our institutions. It's part of how we think about the Constitution and about limits on government and enforcement of limits on government. We'd have a pretty different constitutional order without it. In addition to that, despite their grumbling, politicians actually like judicial review in some ways. It means that they officials and politicians can pass the buck to courts when they want to, when it's in the officials' interest to do it, can blame courts for decisions that are hard to make. And lots of people, politicians, officials, even ordinary poor schmuck citizens like us, actually like the idea, on the right and the left, like the idea of being able to go to an alternative forum to press claims for policy or constitutional claims. So these are facts of life, I think, at this point in history. Not to say that we can't get rid of judicial review. It's perfectly within the scope of imagination to say, okay, yeah, there. I can imagine a constitutional order without judicial review, but this is our system. I expect it'll persist for some time. And so the question really is how and when courts will exercise the power. Now, one thing to say about this, there are a lot of ways in which constitutional arguments are framed in terms of principles and rules and values and that sort of highfalutin, high-minded things. But really, when you get down to it, you want to ask, what's motivating this strenuous objection to a practice? And often it's about status. Sometimes it's about principle. But frequently it's about who gets the stuff. And so remember that. There are also strategic opportunities, which Professor Lindquist is better equipped than I am probably to talk about. But but I do think principle matters, because when people go into constitutional conflicts, they don't say, I want some money, give it to me. They say, there's a principle at stake here. There's a rule that's in play here. They talk a language of rules, values, and principles. And those things, I think, matter because they constrain discourse. So let me talk about a few things related to these rules, principles, and values. One, at the heart of debates about judicial activism is, at least in part, a contest between two competing values or two competing visions of what the Constitution is all about. We can talk, I use terms democracy and liberalism, but you can use different terms. In one camp are people who say that the basic theme of the Constitution, the basic reason for having a Constitution in the first place, is democratic self-government, the representative government. They hold, when in doubt, courts should defer to majoritarian institutions. On the other end of this, even when it's clear that majoritarian decisions pinch, when they hurt individuals. Now, on the other end of the spectrum are proponents of liberalism or rights. They insist with equal vigor that the basic theme, the basic reason for having a constitution in the first place is to protect rights. They say when courts consider claims of constitutionality, courts are justified in protecting persons from overreaching by democratic majorities, even though the majorities and democratic institutions may have pretty decent reasons for doing what they want to do. Now, there are lots of variations on these themes. Legislative versus executive. How important are states in this whole system? How much power is too much power? All that's on the democracy side. On the rights side, you've got questions about which rights are fundamental, which rights are constitutional. Political participation seems fairly non-controversial. Some criminal procedures seem fairly non-controversial, unless you're a detainee in Guantanamo. Rights of property and enterprise, rights of personal autonomy, bodily integrity, dignity, and when, if ever, should these rights give way to common good. But the basic tension, I think, is just built into the system. And the basic tension is not going to go away. It hasn't been resolved yet. It probably won't be resolved in the future. And probably for the good of the constitutional order, it shouldn't be resolved. But it's not just a question of basic themes or values of the Constitution. It's also this issue of judicial activism is also a question about method. How should judges do their jobs, right? What sources should they rely on when they do their jobs? And let me just quickly go through. How much time do I have? Okay. We okay? And here again, we got a basic disagreement. I'm talking about disagreements throughout. Constitution is a family of disagreement. That's the bottom line. First, on the one hand, you got textualists, right? Strict construction, I think, was your phrase, right? And the textualists say, like, we've got this Constitution, it's written down, let's read the thing and let's apply the words. That's pretty intuitively sensible. But on the other end of the spectrum are the kind of extra textualists, for lack of a better phrase. It's in our bill, but there it is. Okay. Judges are entitled to rely on sources outside the text of the Constitution. That's the position of the extra textualists. Now, the textualists criticize this position, this extra textualist position, for several reasons. One, these extra constitutional, extra textual sources are not legitimate sources for judicial use. Second, they're anti-democratic. And third, to the extent that the extra textualists want to rely on considerations of natural right or natural justice, that reliance is just a pretext for judges imposing their personal preferences on the rest of us, and that can't be legitimate. That's the textualist critique. Now, the extra textualists criticize the textualists. They're insensitive to the role of justice in the judicial function, and in the constitutional order, for that matter. And the extra textualists say textualism is actually a deceit on some level. It's a fraud. It's a fraud in this way. You can't get definitive answers to interesting constitutional questions strictly out of the text. You have to, even if you take the text seriously, you have to rely on other sources. You mentioned due process of law, equal protection of law, cruel and unusual punishments. Those are just examples of general ambiguous phrases in the Constitution, and the text doesn't supply, according to the extra textualist critique, answers to them or definitions of these terms. Now, the textualists that's not the end of the game for them. They've got another strategy in their back pocket, and the strategy is originalism. Or framer's intent, right? And so we say, well, where there is ambiguity, sure, we got to rely on other sources, but we'll rely on the intentions of the people who framed the document. Who better to ask about the meaning of the Constitution than the people who made the thing? But that move, too, is controversial because the extra textualist critique originalism on any number of fronts. One is that it's hard to figure out what the original intent was. For the examples of our framers at the beginning of my remarks are one example of that. Sometimes intentions or understandings conflict with one another, and sometimes they're just as ambiguous as the texts that they're designed to illuminate. But in addition, even if we had perfectly clear direction from the framers, The one set of criticisms is that we should not be bound to those understandings because we today, including judges today, are entitled to read the Constitution on our own terms. It's our way of kind of connecting to, attaching to the Constitution. And we're entitled not to be bound by what's called the dead hand of the past, right? Okay, with all the disagreement, it'd be nice if there were some non-controversial ways of making sense of the Constitution, right? There are three. Let me put them out as non-controversial. One, judges should follow precedent, right? Should follow decisions that have been laid down, right? Questions. One, what if you've got a case of first impression where there is arguably no prior decision on point. What if it's the case, and this is some first-year law students learn, first semester, right? Hey, precedents are, I was going to say manipulable. Precedents are malleable, right? And it's part of the lawyer's job to learn, and it's part of the judge's job, in fact, to learn how to use them in ways that may not be on all fours with the holding of the case. And three, aren't there times when it's proper for a court to turn its back on precedent? You can think of Brown versus Board and Plessy versus Ferguson in this regard. Now, these are just facts. These are, I think, facts of life. These questions about the use of precedent are facts. Are considerations in the application of precedent that make precedent not constraining in a tight way. That doesn't turn judges into legislators, but it does give them freedom within the confines of a conventional judicial role. Second possible non-controversial constraint is self-restraint. That is, judges will just restrain themselves. Now, you've got the question of, do we trust the judges? And here, Brutus and Hamilton come back in, because Hamilton wants to say, sure, oh, yes, judges are trained, they're professionals, don't try this at home. They have integrity, they have character, and permanent tenure guarantees that integrity and character. And so, yeah, trust. Brutus says that's insane, because you don't trust anybody in political system. Everybody's grasping for power, and judges are no exception to that rule. Okay. Third non-controversial source is that there are other institutions that are at play, and there is no question but that those institutions, on some level, operate to constrain judicial function, especially not less states than presidents and Congress, to some extent citizens generally, in different times, in different ways, they can be more or less effective in acting independently from courts and in some ways resisting courts. And we see the present administration trying to find a way to resist the court's decision in Hamdan, right? And how do we get around this holding that Geneva Conventions may prohibit what we've been doing? Bottom line, the world is complex. I mean, the constitutional world is complex, and it's useful to acknowledge that fact. Now, that's not an argument for just shrugging shoulders and saying, it's all going to be okay. It's not an argument for being sanguine about the judicial role. For one thing, the value of collective government is important. In an expansive conception, a too expansive conception, a too vigorous commitment to judges deciding our conflicts for us can weaken self-government. For another, Supreme Court's not been exactly a model of consistency over the years. And for another, even if you like rights, the Supreme Court has not been, its record on rights has not been consistently stellar. And I won't give you examples, but from my perch, the record is frequently less than inspiring. Still on the whole, I think it's fair to say that in garden variety disputes, the court does a respectable job. Certainly the case that the court, as pointed out, rarely strays from kind of preferences of dominant elites. Whether that's reassuring or not, I guess, is an open question, but it's at least a constraint. But the bottom line is this: if the record isn't such as to kindle burning confidence in courts, I don't think it's enough to incite substantial fear about them either. So that's where I'll stop, I think. Okay.
Well, I am going to use a PowerPoint because I need it. All right, my name's, thank you. My name is Tommy Traxler, and I'm a senior political science major. And he'll introduce himself, but this is Lawrence. He's also a senior political science major. And we're going to look at judicial activism from a political perspective. And that is, how's judicial activism used as a political issue in today's politics? And before we begin, I believe there's a few questions that we need to ask ourselves to provide a foundation throughout the entire presentation. And that's, first of all, why has judicial activism become such a talking point in the political arena? Who uses political activism as a political issue? How is it used? Who's affected by it? Why are they affected? And do the politics of judicial activism have an effect on the federal judiciary? And if so, what are those effects? In short, does it affect how judges go about their everyday business? Also, we have, what are the political uses of judicial activism? Is it used as a political football? And if so, whose? What is its effect on American politics in terms of partisan agendas and electoral politics? So let's start off with the question, whose issue is political activism? Does it belong to the Republicans or does it belong to the Democrats? Professor Bruce Oppenheimer, he's an expert on legislative affairs here at Vanderbilt, and the Congressional Quarterly agreed that currently Republicans dominate the issue. And if anybody follows campaigns and politics here, you always hear Republican rhetoric of judges who legislate from the bench and liberal activist judges, and it's used and frequently to mobilize the social conservative base in campaigns today. However, while they lash out at what they call liberal activist judges, as Dr. Lindquist pointed out earlier, it's also important to note that currently over half of the federal judges sitting on the bench were nominated by Republican presidents. So oftentimes they're attacking their own judges that they in fact put on the bench. But it's also important to note that both sides use judicial activism when it's convenient. That is, when a judge rules in a way that's deemed unacceptable to a particular party, they're going to lash out and accuse that judge of being a judicial activist. Therefore, there's no sole ownership on the issue of either side. Republicans will attack judicial activism when it goes against them. Democrats will attack judicial activism when it goes against them. And it all comes down to whose ox is being gored at the time. Who's getting the raw end of the deal? And when it happens, as Professor Brandon said, it's easy just to pass the buck and blame the courts. So as we pointed out, currently the Republicans dominate the issue of political activism, legislating from the bench, liberal activist judges, used in campaigns all the time to mobilize the conservative base. And so in order to understand how judicial activism plays a role in today's modern political arena, the conservative viewpoint must be understood. And this cartoon right here provides a very reflective sentiment of conservatives towards judicial activism. Because in this cartoon you have two kids, a father and a son, who are talking to a judge holding a thing that says Darwin in school and a gavel. And behind them is a public high school, and the judge is pointing to a Sunday school that says creationism, and he says, but you're still free to study intelligent design, implying that you're no longer able to hear about creationism in school or intelligent design in high school and public schools, but you can go to church to hear it. And what that does is that's very reflective on what conservatives feel that liberal activist judges, the effects that they have on traditional social values, in this case, a broad interpretation of church and state, a broad interpretation of the separation of church and state. And to understand the current modern conservative dissatisfaction with judicial activism, you have to go back all the way back to the 1950s. And looking around, I see that there's not many of us here from the 1950s. But it's important to know that for many social conservatives, this is a time of nostalgia, as a time when traditional American values reign supreme. It's a time of the nuclear family. It's a time of post-war optimism, the baby boom, the GI Bill, rise out of the Great Depression and into prosperity, the founding of suburban America, and TV shows that we only know of is coming on at late at Nick at Night, and that's I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, and Father Knows Best, now replaced by MTV and VH1. But there's also many social ills at the time that you have to recognize, and that's racial discrimination, McCarthyism, and limited opportunities for women. That's just to name a few. Now, Professor Oppenheimer and another professor from Clemson University, David Woodard, who's a big Republican activist, agreed that it was Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 that really began the modern conservative concern about judicial activism and complaints about judicial activism. And as they pointed out, it was, you know, a good decision, a good example of judicial activism furthering a good cause. But according to conservatives, what Brown versus Board did is allow sociological debate to be used to do what Congress could not in racial segregation. And the use of this sociological debate and sociological evidence, they felt should have been used in the legislatures, not by the court. So it opened the door for liberal judges to stray from the Constitution and impose their own personal preferences and values on society. And according to many social conservatives, these liberal activist judges walked right through that door. And these judges were part, furthermore, of a liberal elite who were out of touch with mainstream Americans and traditional American values. And one example is Earl Warren, the Chief Justice at the time of Brown versus Board, who's well known as a very liberal Chief Justice and a lot of progress during his time. President Eisenhower, a Republican who happened to nominate Earl Warren to be Chief Justice, later said that Earl Warren was the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. And there was backlash against Earl Warren all across the country, mainly in the South, and there was a huge campaign to have him impeached as a Supreme Court justice. In 1958, in a lesser-known case in Brown versus Board, the Warren Court handed down a case called Trott versus Dulles, and it's a case involving whether or not it was cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to revoke a military deserter's citizenship. And in the majority opinion, the court wrote, "The words of the Eighth Amendment are not precise, and that their scope is not static. The amendment must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society." Now, it's important to just read those words again and realize what he's in fact saying. And he's saying that the Constitution is not a dead document. It's not to be written, read textually, as Professor Brandon said, but to be interpreted in keeping with the times. It must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. So according to the Warren Court, the Constitution was very much alive. And according to conservatives, the result of this opinion is that many liberal judges now saw themselves acting as a voice to guide this maturing society, thus taking the role of the legislatures out when they put their own policy preferences in. And during the 1960s and 1970s, the Warren Court and the Burger Courts saw a growth in criminal suspect rights, a newly found right to privacy, a newly found right to an abortion, a stricter separation of church and state, the school busing issue, and many other more liberal causes that caused conservatives around the country great concern. And perhaps another monumental case that's very telling still today, and when you hear about abortion and confirmation hearings and when discussing legislators from the bench, is Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a newly found right to privacy was discovered in the Constitution. And many conservatives then and many conservatives still today do not understand how after 200 years, a right to privacy was suddenly just discovered in the Constitution, as if it had been eluding Supreme Court justices for the past two centuries. And in that opinion, Justice William O. Douglas argued that it was in the spirit of the Constitution, the penumbra, and although it was not specifically stated, it was there. And conservatives still have a hard time trying to figure out where exactly in the first 10 amendments that right to privacy is. So that right to privacy was used later to establish, 8 years later, in Roe versus Wade, a right to an abortion, which just made the Republicans that much more angry. Because now not only did they have a newly found right to privacy, but there's a newly found right to an abortion. And so this proved to conservatives around the nation that liberal judges were actively bypassing legislatures and imposing their values on the American people. And they were interpreting the Constitution in ways that they saw fit to fix what they perceived to be social ills. And Senator John Ashcroft, before he became the infamous attorney general, referred to this as social engineering, liberal courts actively attempting to fix social ills, and asked what happened to elected legislatures. So activist judges, according to Professor Woodard, were then and now taking on the role of rewriting in America what is right and what is wrong, not in adherence to traditional American values, but their own policy preferences, and being members of an elite, liberal elite in this nation. So here we are today. And as a cartoon that was printed in 2001 suggests, conservatives still view activist judges as a threat to traditional American values. In recent cases, such as Lawrence versus Texas, striking down anti-sodomy laws in Texas, and Newdo versus the United States, where the Ninth Circuit deemed that the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance were unconstitutional, and other cases just seem to confirm this to conservatives. And in the next few slides, you'll see a lot of examples coming from Republican politicians, where you really see what their beef is with activist judges, and that normally comes in the case of criminal rights and family values. So right here you have a quote by former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Orrin Hatch, in 1997, where he says, "A judicial activist is simply put a judge who exceeds the proper limits of his or her authority and usurps the authority delegated to another branch or institution of government. In its most basic sense, activism is when judges make the law instead of applying it." Now that definition is very much in keeping with what we've heard from Professors Brandon and Lindquist. But what's very telling is when you look at the examples he uses further in the speech to back his claim up and that there's a problem with judicial activism today. Because his examples pertain mostly to criminal rights or family values. As in the case of one he specifically cited, a 1996 Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, Boring versus Buncombe City Board of Education, where he attacks a Clinton appointee, Judge Motz, for her opinion finding a First Amendment right for a teacher to conduct a play which depicts, and this is coming straight from the opinion, the dynamics within a dysfunctional single-parent family, a divorced mother and three daughters, one a lesbian, another pregnant with an illegitimate child. And just from that description alone, you can see where this would conflict with what many social conservatives deem to be traditional American values and family values. That's not exactly your standard nuclear family. Here you have President Bush, who also lashes out against judicial activism in both of his campaigns and still does today. And he, in the quote below, when nominating his first federal judges to the bench, describes his ideal role of a federal judge. And that is, he says, "Every judge I appoint will be a person who clearly understands the role of a judge is to interpret the law, not to legislate from the bench. That is, not to engage in social engineering and applying their own policy beliefs on American people." And here you have Majority Leader Senator Bill Frist. And the picture right here is from Justice Sunday, recently held within the past year, where it was a rally done by Christian Conservative Rights and the Family Research Council to call on Democrats to quit filibustering against what they called strict constitutionalist judges. And Senator Frist did not exactly address them in person, but came through on a video feed telling them that he was supporting them. But this is a quote from his political action committee, VOLPAC, on their website, where he's describing his role in confirming President Bush's judicial nominees. And in this long quote, you'll be able to see more examples of the kind of problems that social conservatives have with judicial activists. He says, "And because we acted today, we're one step closer to an America where activist judges can't clear the way for local governments to seize your private property and hand it off to a private developer. An America where activist judges cannot take upon themselves to override the common sense of the American people and redefine the institution of marriage. An America where activist judges can't declare that a 14-year-old girl can walk into a clinic and have an abortion without her parents' consent. By the end of his presidency, George W. Bush will have not appointed one out of every three of the 871 federal judges serving this nation. Conservative judges, judges who interpret the law and not legislate from the bench." So in that quote, you have abortion and you have the institution of marriage, both of which are hot topics for social conservatives. So legislating from the bench, conservatives have obviously made nominating conservative judges who were strict constitutionalists and not judicial activists and will not legislate from the bench, a top priority. During election time, this issue is commonly used to fire up the right-wing base, especially single-issue voters such as anti-abortion people, the Christian right, advocates of gun ownership and whatnot. It's commonly used to fire them up and mobilize them to come out to vote. The term not legislating from the bench comes to mean jurists who will not further encroach on traditional American values and impose their policy preferences on the American people. And the hope is that not only will these judges not further encroach on them, but they'll overturn some of the cases that already have. And which begs the question, will Roe v. Wade ever be overturned? We hear that all the time in confirmation hearings. I guess we'll see in the soon future. So what does this rhetoric about judicial activism have on the judiciary itself? Does it affect how federal judges go about their everyday business in deciding on cases and ruling on cases? And to put it quite simply, no, it does not. Judges have their own philosophies, and they don't actively seek to advance a party's agenda, no matter how much people speculate. Each judge is confirmed with his own philosophy, and they rule in a manner that they see right, that they see as right, in adherence to that philosophy. It's important to remember that presidents are going to nominate judges who share their philosophy. So while it may seem like they're actively seeking to advance a party's agenda, odds are they probably are not. They're just ruling in manner of their philosophy. And also, federal judges are confirmed for life. They get lifetime tenures, so they could really care less, you know, if a person calls them a judicial activist, because naturally, when it comes to a case in law and judges, one side's going to be unhappy with the opinion because one side loses. So they're going to feel that the judge ruled incorrectly. So judges don't really care about the labels that are attached to them. And so, to sum it up, the politicizing of judicial activism does not really affect how judges go about their business. And I believe Lawrence is going to talk more about the role of judicial activism in politics.
Good afternoon. I'm Lawrence Staton. I'm a senior in College of Arts and Science, political science major. And I'd like to begin by saying judicial activism sort of reminds me of an episode of Family Guy. And they're all sitting around the table. They're talking about the problems in the family. And Peter Griffin says, we're just going to ignore it like we ignore the squid in the room. And it cuts to a giant squid that sort of knocks the table over, and they pretend like it's not there. However, I prefer the analogy also of judicial activism being a loaded gun. Both parties have it, and it's only bad if it's pointed at your head. Conservatives see social activism by liberals. They look at Roe versus Wade or Lawrence versus Texas, as was previously mentioned. Liberals see civil activism by the conservatives in the FISA cases and the NSA cases, as well as Bush versus Gore. It's also an 800-pound gorilla. It causes a lot of things in the political realm. And we're going to take a look at the political effects, how it affects elections. We have midterm elections coming up, and I'm sure this is going to be an issue in the midterm elections. We have a presidential election. It's going to be an issue in presidential elections. How did it become an issue in elections? After the 1994 congressional elections, when the Republicans took control of Congress for the first time in 40 years, they realized that they had a serious problem, and that was that the judiciary of the United States didn't fit with the conservative ideology. So what did they do? They took it upon themselves to redefine judicial activism. And they defined it as the imperial out-of-control judiciary. In a Washington Times article by Senators Orrin Hatch and Senator Sam Brownback, who is a presidential candidate for a contender in the 2008 election in 2005, they wrote, in their wake, meaning the judicial activists, the Constitution lies in shambles. Statutes passed by the people's representatives are in the dumpster, the rule of law loses its vitality, and once again, the people are deprived of the right to govern themselves and define the culture. So why define judicial activism in this way? Namely, two reasons. One, to advance a partisan agenda, and two, to improve your electoral fortunes. So what are the politics of activism? How do we define judicial activism? When the conservatives see liberals as activists, and the liberals see the conservatives as activists, how do we define it? Let's have a new perspective. The import of the cases has seen liberal activism. Segregation, Brown versus Board of Education. Abortion, Roe versus Wade. But there is another example of conservative activism that the liberals would say not so good for the conservative side. And that's Bush versus Gore. And many of you will recall that on November 2nd, 2000, in 2000, the presidential election came under dispute over recount of votes. We became more familiar with pregnant Chads, hanging Chads, and other things named Chad than we probably ever will want to be in our lives. The Supreme Court, after weeks of wrangling, held that Florida's electors intended to participate in the federal electoral process. And the statute of state law compelled them to do so by December 12, 2000. The court held that the statute in turn requires that any controversy or contest that is designed to lead to a conclusive selection of electors be completed by December the 12th. The court also held that that date is upon us, and there is no recount procedure in place under the state Supreme Court standards that comports with minimal constitutional deadlines. The rest, as you say, is history. We know what happened. What, pray tell, is the aftermath of Bush versus Gore? Well, first, we must understand that the perception of the court matters. My colleagues mentioned the role of stare decisis. The court has to uphold its precedent. It can't be ruling one way and then 5 years later turning around another way, or else nobody really will pay attention to what the court says. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 94 did say that the court neither has neither purse nor sword to make law. Historically, the Supreme Court has always had the highest approval ratings. This went down after the Bush versus Gore decision, and there's a Bush versus Gore effect. The conservatives all of a sudden began to praise the Supreme Court, and the liberals all of a sudden criticized the court. So we have this view of the judiciary that is skewered by partisanship. This is some interesting data I found from the Gallup organization, looking at voters who had quite a lot or a great deal of confidence in the Supreme Court before and after the Bush versus Gore decision. As you can see, among the national adults and voters, 47% of the voters before the decision had a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court. After the decision, 49%. Not much change there. But let's look at the breakdown by party. Before the Bush versus Gore decision, 48%. After the decision, 67%. That's an increase of 19%. Wonder why the conservatives suddenly like the Supreme Court. The independents, 48% before Bush versus Gore, 45% afterwards. The Democrats, 44% had a great deal of confidence before the decision, 40% afterwards. Decreased by the independents of 3% and 4% by the Democrats. Now let's take a look at those who had some or very little confidence in the Supreme Court. Again, not much change in some very little confidence in the Supreme Court before and after the decision. Again, not a whole lot of change among the national view. But if we look at it by party, 50% had some or very little confidence before the decision. That number dropped to 32% after the decision. Independents, 46% said they had very little confidence in the court, 52 afterwards. 50% by the Democrats, 56 after the decision. Again, nationally, unchanged. By party, the number of Republicans changed a great deal. Independents increased 6 percentage points, and Democrats also increased 6 percentage points. So we have to realize now that judicial activism is based on the philosophy of root, root, root for the home team. You can tell I'm a baseball fan. Controversial issues stir up the bases. The conservative base is energized on issues like abortion and gay rights. The liberal base is energized to protect the current status quo of the liberal decision from the 60s and 70s. Who is motivated by judicial activism? Most likely, it's highly motivated single-issue voters, particularly those voters who vote in primary elections. The 2004 presidential election saw judicial activism become very important. I'm going to let President Bush and Senator Kerry speak for themselves as they did at the debates. Senator Kerry, on the judges, he wrote, "I'm not going to appoint a judge to the court who's going to undo a constitutional right, whether it's the First Amendment, or some other right that's given under our courts today, under the Constitution. Kerry continued, I subscribe to the Justice Potter Stewart standard. He was a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States, and he said that the mark of a good judge, a good justice, is that when you're reading their decision, their opinion, you can't tell if it's written by a man or a woman, a liberal or a conservative, a Muslim, a Jew, or a Christian. You just know that you're reading good judicial decisions. He continued, will we have equal opportunity? Will women's rights be protected? Will we have equal pay for women? Which is going backwards. Will a woman's right to choose be protected? These are constitutional rights, and I want to make sure we have judges who interpret the Constitution of the United States according to the law. President Bush on judges countered, what he's asking me is, will I have a litmus test for my judges? And the answer is no, I will not have a litmus test. I will pick judges who will interpret the Constitution, but I'll have no litmus test. Bush continued, I would pick somebody who would not allow their personal opinion to get in the way of the law. I would pick somebody who would strictly interpret the Constitution of the United States. I wouldn't pick a judge who said that the Pledge of Allegiance couldn't be said in a school because it had the words under God in it. I think that's an example of a judge allowing personal opinion to enter into the decision-making process as opposed to a strict interpretation of the Constitution. So you can see there's some similar rhetoric there, but again, both parties use it as they see fit. Kerry saying he would nominate moderates who would preserve the status quo, Bush saying he would appoint strict constructionalists and conservative judges. So how will this affect the politics of the future? Presidents and parties use judicial activism. They use it to advance partisan agendas. Again, the GOP railing against the imperial judiciary after they take control in 1994. They use it to shore up their electoral base, featured prominently in the 2004 election by President Bush and Senator Kerry. They use it to motivate their bases. Only losers are motivated by an activist court, meaning if the issue affects you personally, you're going to come out. If it's going to change the law of the country and affect your political philosophy, you're going to be motivated. The GOP used abortion and gay marriage in the 2004 election. The caveat of activism is this. A judiciary is only activist if they are against your personal views. We've had a conservative judiciary for a number of years. Conservative activism takes a different form from liberal activism, but it's still there. Also, finally, to remember, always, judicial activism is a loaded gun. Everybody has it, everybody points it, and one day it will become a smoking gun. Thank you. I'm going to turn it back over to Ms. Archer.
Thank you very much. And